Okay, we're coming to part one, file one, if you have your computers open and ready. And you see up on the board, let me see if I can get that a little larger for those of you who are without notes this evening. I want to begin the first lecture by just giving you a sense of where we're going. I always like to know where someone's going when they're preaching or teaching, and how long it's going to take us to get there, and what we're going to see along the way. So there you see the three parts of the course. Part one, historical introductions, what I call the Great Conversation, and subtitled Eschatology Made Difficult by Men. And then part two, structural considerations, what over several many years of teaching eschatology, I've come to think of as eschatology made simple. And then part three of the course is special questions, or next question, please. And here we work through, hey, Shad, good to see you. Here we'll work through in kind of chronological order the major questions that people have about eschatology, or the issues that have been raised in the process of Christians thinking about this. And so we go from the Gospel Age, dealing with the intermediate state, the earthly prospects of the Church-Israel distinction, to the imminent return of Christ, and there we deal with three issues related to the whole subject of the imminent return of Christ: pre-tribulationism, what I've called calculationism, and also preterism. And there I have in mind, actually, I probably should say hyperpreterism. And then section three deals with the bodily resurrection. And section four, the eternal state of the wicked, and in particular, the doctrine of eternal punishment. And then the eternal state of the righteous, and in particular, the doctrine of the redeemed earth. Okay? So that's where we're going. And this evening, my hope is to cover part one of the course. And so here we go. You've had the experience of coming in late to a conversation at a restaurant or at church, and people are talking in a rather animated way about something, but you don't know what they're talking about, and they're using maybe some language that you've never heard before, or terminology or vocabulary, and you're not one of those irritating people that kind of just bust into an ongoing conversation and say, "What are you talking about? What are you talking about?" And demand to be noticed and explained to. You know that you should courteously listen to try to catch up on what's going on in the conversation. Well, here in 2012, that auspicious year, designated so by no less authority than the Mayan calendar, here in 2012, we are coming this evening to listen in on a great conversation. This is a conversation that's been going on for almost 2,000 years. If you think that arguments over eschatology began in the 19th century or the 20th century, you're wrong. Christians have disagreed, apparently, about eschatology and some issues in eschatology for as far back as we have Christian writings. One of the things I want to do, and I think we need to do as we join this conversation, is listen to it and get an idea of what people have been talking about in this great conversation about eschatology, or the doctrine of last things, that's been going on for almost these 2,000 years. One of the things this will help us do is get our vocabulary straight. You know, there's all sorts of language. I've even used some of it here in my outline about premillennialism and postmillennialism and tribulation and gospel age and the coming of Christ and all of this stuff that we may not be familiar with. And so one of the things that listening for a little while to this conversation that's been going on in the church is going to help us with is get our vocabulary, our conversation, our options even straight, okay? So, Christians have been talking about this subject for a long time. We're going to listen to the conversation. What I'm really going to try to do this evening is kind of summarize that conversation, show you what people have been talking about, where the discussion has gone, what some of the issues that have been raised are, what Christians disagree about, what Christians don't disagree about. That's what I want to do. And I hope that even though my experience says that the reaction of many men that I've taught this to and women is that this gets a little confusing and conflicting as we go along because of all the bypaths that theologians and teachers in the church have gone into. I still think that in the long run it's going to be helpful for us to familiarize ourselves with this conversation before we try to join it, okay? So that's what we're going to try to do this evening. And we're going to have to be patient for a couple of reasons. First, we're going to have to be patient because this conversation's going on for a long time, you understand. And so I'm going to do my best to give you the highlights of 2,000 years of conversation, and that's no little task. When I look at something, you know, this book right here is a discussion of just one issue over about 250 years of church history. And it's just one of many eschatological issues that he deals with. And so some people even think that what may appear to you to be the really in-depth treatment of the history of eschatology in the church, many people would say that I'm being really superficial. I hope I'm not. I hope I'm being simple. I hope I'm not being simplistic. But at any rate, I hope I don't try your patience too much this evening. I hope that you'll trust me when I say it'll be useful for you to know what we're saying and to go over this material as we come in part two of the course to ask, what does the Bible say about all this stuff? We're going to set, one of the things we're going to do is set before us kind of the menu, that we have in front of us to choose from, the options that we have to choose from as Christians, the different ways that Orthodox Christians have gone with regard to the teaching of eschatology. And then, when we come to the Bible, we're going to be able to, read it, I think, as we often do, with more perception, because we have questions that we're asking. We know what the questions are. And then we can go to the Bible more thoughtfully to get our answers. Okay? Now, there's a second reason why you're going to have to be patient. And it's because not all the things we're going to talk about, quite frankly, make a whole lot of sense. And some of the viewpoints and positions that people have taken may strike you as not very sensible. Frankly, some of the viewpoints and options and things that people have said don't strike me as very sensible. And, you know, you just have to exercise the virtue of patience like you do with all sorts of people in life, of being patient to let them say things that aren't sensible and just not throw up your hands and walk away. Okay? So you have to appreciate that in one sense, this study of the history of eschatology in the church can be subtitled Eschatology Made Complicated by Men. When I think, and one of my arguments is going to be that the actual teaching of the Bible is fairly simple and straightforward. Almost one of the problems has been that it's too simple. Okay? But hang in there and persevere. And let me ask you to remember two things that may help you to do that. First, remember that this whole conversation, someplace in it, the Spirit of Christ has been active. You know, Christ promised to be with his church wherever they went, discipling men and teaching them to observe all things that he'd commanded. He promised to be with them, Matthew 28:20. So while church history isn't our authority, we do have to acknowledge that when the psalmist says, great are the works of the Lord studied by all those who delight in them, the church history wouldn't exist, has been driven along by the Lord. And so, while this doesn't mean that everything that Christian teachers or even great Christian teachers have said is true, it does mean that in this conversation, there's been truth being developed someplace. Now, the only standard or arbiter for where we find that truth and how we evaluate this conversation is, of course, the Bible. But, you know, and on the other hand, remember, we're listening to the great teachers of the church. And these teachers were the gifts of Christ to the church. And though they weren't right about everything, they were given to the church to bring the church to mature man, to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. So in this listening to the great teachers of the church, there is truth being understood, developed, articulated, and the church's understanding of truth is being deepened. No, the deposit of truth we have in the Word of God never changes. But the church's ability to understand that deposit has been developing and progressing for 2,000 years. And that's one of the reasons why we need to listen in on this conversation. Christ has been building his church. Christ has been with his church, Matthew 16, Matthew 28. And therefore, we need to listen to what these great teachers of the church who have been being taught by the Holy Spirit have said. Even though not everything they've said has been right, they have been gifts to the church. And we are obligated by that very fact to accept those gifts and listen to those gifts and learn from those gifts. Okay? The second reason why it's a good thing to study this subject is it does set before us, and I said this before, but I want to say it, the basic options. You know, when you first approach the subject of eschatology, you go to a bookstore or something, again, the complexity can seem mind-boggling. You know, he says this, and he says that, and he says the other thing, and what? That's not quite the same here, and they seem to be on a completely different page over there. And is that even orthodox? And is that even in the Christian tradition? And so what studying church history does is it gives you an idea of what your menu options are as you read the Bible. And I'm going to argue that in church history, there are basically four orthodox. I didn't say they're each correct. They, in fact, each can't be correct. But there are basically four orthodox eschatological positions, four eschatological positions that have been believed deeply by genuine Christians. And that being the case, if we can come to understand those positions and have them clear in our minds, those four, there are lots of variations within the four, of course, but those four basic positions, and we can bring that clarity of, here are my options, to the Bible, we're going to be able to make our choices in a much better way. We're going to be able to read the Bible in a much more effective way and get answers to our questions more effectively if we know what our options are. And studying church history basically has for one of its values to show us what our options are. Okay? Well, we need to break up this long history into bite-sized chunks. And here's how we're going to do it. You see it there. Commonly, this is not the only way it's done, but commonly, church history is divided into four parts. Early church history, which I began after the last apostle died, I don't think that apostolic history and church history belong in the same category. Yes, you might discern from my saying that I'm a cessationist. Yes, that's true. And I believe that apostolic history and church history are two very different things. One contains men that are authoritative, the other does not. But anyway, our early church history runs from about 100, shortly after the last apostle died, to around the year 400. These are round numbers, of course, but there are reasons for them. Medieval church history runs from then till about the year 1500. Shortly thereafter, of course, the Reformation kicks off. And then I think modern church history begins, I have here 1600, there's a good case to be made for 1700, but at any rate, because I think we ought to identify modern church history, and it is distinguished by its taking place in the age of the Enlightenment, which really begins around the year 1700. So, at any rate, those are the four major periods of church history as they're commonly divided. Now, the major periods of intense doctrinal discussion about the subject of eschatology have been in the early church and in the modern church. And therefore, that's what this treatment of the history of eschatology will treat. First, we're going to look at eschatology in the early and medieval church periods and the the balance of our time will be spent on early church history, and then we're going to look at eschatology and the Reformation and modern periods of the church, and the balance of our time will be taken up in modern church history, 1700 and afterwards, okay? So if you have in your notes the year 1600, well, you can't change it unless you print yourself a PDF copy, but at any rate, it should be 1700. I think that's better and accords with what we're going to see. Okay. I've run through that pretty quickly. Any questions about that's kind of all introductory material to tell you why we're going to do what we're going to do this evening. I hope it's helpful to you. Okay, we're going to file two then, which is section one of part one, the Great Conversation in the Early and Medieval Church. And here I'm going to slow down and pay a little more attention to my notes. Now, this conversation in early and medieval church about eschatology, and especially in the early church, I think can be best summarized with three P's. Preface, presentation, postscript, okay? Preface. I've already implied that there's difference of opinion about eschatology about as far back as we can trace Christian thinking on the subject after the age of the apostles. The conversation about it has been characterized by disagreement, but though that's the main emphasis of section one, I want to say very clearly and at the outset that this conflict took place against the backdrop of some things that really Christians completely agreed about. It took place against the backdrop of basic agreement about certain core beliefs. And what core beliefs am I talking about? Well, I'm talking about the basic doctrines of the second coming of Christ, eternal punishment, and the bodily resurrection of Christians, and indeed of all men. Reinhold Seeberg says, notice the quotation, as he comments on early church history, there is a vivid sense of the vanity and the perishable nature of this world, and of the glory of the eternal world, as well as the terrible character of the torments of hell. And then he cites the Apocalypse of Peter, which isn't in their New Testaments. It's a pseudepigraphical book. The end of all things is thought to be very near. The chief thing remained the final judgment of the world, and the certainty that the holy shall go to heaven to God and the unholy to hell. This was involved in the idea of reward for earthly conduct. Now, in the very early work entitled The Martyrdom of Polycarp, Seeber's comments are confirmed. And here's what we read in this early work. And again, he said to him, this is the Roman official speaking to Polycarp, the bishop of Lyon in Gaul, I shall have you consumed with fire if you despise the wild beast, unless you change your mind. But Polycarp said, the fire you threaten burns but an hour, and is quenched after a little, for you do not know the fire of the coming judgment and everlasting punishment that is laid up for the impious. But why do you delay? Come do what you will. It's also clear, even in the earliest Christians' writings, that the bodily resurrection, both of Christ and of Christians, the resurrection, which is pointedly called the resurrection of the flesh, is emphasized as important to Christianity as over against the Gnostic denial of the importance of the flesh and the Greek idea that the body is merely the prison house of the soul. No, the body is important for Christians. Its resurrection is crucial. And so in the Apostolic Fathers book known as Second Clement, we read, moreover, let none of you say that this flesh will not be judged or rise again. Consider this. In what state were you saved? In what state did you regain your sight, if it was not while you were in the flesh? Therefore, we should guard the flesh as God's temple. For just as you were called in the flesh, you will come, that is to say, come in the resurrection, in the flesh. If Christ the Lord who saved us was made flesh, though he was at first spirit, and called us in this way, in the same way we too in this very flesh will receive our reward. So here's what I'm saying. The animated debate that took place in the early church over eschatology must not disguise the underlying commitment of these brethren to the fundamentals of Christian eschatology. I have a lecture, I'm not going to do it this week, but a lecture in which I emphasize this, especially trying to show what the boundaries of orthodoxy are in Christian eschatology. Some people have the idea that it really doesn't matter at all what you believe about eschatology. Nothing could be further from the truth. And I hope that this week eschatology is going to be helpful to you to learn, because it's going to give you kind of a couple of other reasons besides the one I'm commenting on right now. I hope eschatology will help you understand, I guess, what I'm going to call the skeleton of the Bible. The Bible is a book of redemptive history. The Bible is all about the history of redemption. Okay? And that's what eschatology is about. It's about history. It's about a certain part of history, the end of history. But the end of history can't be separated from your understanding of the entirety of history. And so to understand the Bible, which is a book about redemptive history, the Bible's not basically a code of ethics. It's not basically a systematic theology. It's not basically a lot of things. It's the basis for all of those things, but the Bible is basically a book of redemptive history. And therefore, you can't understand it until you have a basic understanding of what redemptive history is. And once you understand redemptive history, you understand a whole lot about eschatology, because it doesn't change when it gets to the end, okay? The other thing is this. Eschatology, the Bible is the gospel story. Eschatology is the end of the story. Now, you know how important the end of the story is. Notwithstanding Hollywood's tendency to have various endings to their stories, we know that the whole story depends on how it ends. Eschatology is about the end of the story. Now, so there are really good reasons to study, important reasons to study eschatology and not to diss prophecy, and if it's studied in the right way. But I'm going to go back now to what I was saying. The fact is, there were core beliefs in the early church that set the boundaries of orthodoxy. Those core beliefs, which all Christians in the early church believed, which are enshrined and embodied in the earliest confessions we have from the early church, the Apostles' Creed, the Nicene Creed, and onward, these early confessions enshrine certain eschatological perspectives. No, they don't settle the issue of the millennium or the tribulation. But what they do settle is this. Christ is coming back visibly. The body is going to be resurrected, and there will be eternal punishment. Now, what I want to say to you is those three great doctrines are the core beliefs that Christians must be committed to, and which, if they give up, while giving them up, they give up Christianity. You can't give up the second coming of Christ. You can't give up the bodily resurrection. And you can't give up eternal punishment without giving up Christianity. Okay? These doctrines are essential to what Christianity is. I believe in the resurrection of the flesh. I'll come right to you, Andrew, in a second. So, you say, where are you going with this? Well, what I think this means is, liberalism with this denial of a supernatural second coming of Christ, hyperpreterism with this denial of a bodily resurrection, are heretical. And by the most basic understanding of those words in church history, they give up core beliefs of the Christian faith. The notion that Christ came back for the last time in AD 70 and everybody was raised from the dead, even though their bodies are still in the grave, that notion is heretical. The notion that Christ is never coming back, supernaturally, visibly, bodily, and that the whole notion of eternal rewards is not true, then what basically comes of the Enlightenment kind of liberalism, those notions are heretical. They are not Christian. And insofar as that's the case, eschatology is vital to the Christian faith. Andrew.
I'm not sure if there's a better time to ask this, but with annihilationists like Philip Hughes or John Stott, who otherwise seem to be orthodox, I mean, how do they fit into that scheme?
That's a great question, and I am not ready to say that they're heretical, because annihilationism, though I think it's a really, really serious error, doesn't deny eternal life for Christians, and they try to accommodate themselves in some of their language to eternal punishment. On the other hand, I don't think we can say it's a little error or an error that can be overlooked when someone gives up the doctrine of eternal punishment. Certainly, that doctrine is clearly at the core of everything and every early Christian's doctrine of eschatology. So, no, I don't want to say Stott's not a Christian insofar as he might have held that, or other men, because it's not quite the same thing. But they are very serious errors, and the fact that some evangelicals have been inclined to them shouldn't make us depreciate how serious they are, okay? Other questions? Okay. So having said all of that, now we come to the issue, which is actually stated in the subtitle of Hill's book, Regnum Caelorum, Patterns of Millennial Thought in Early Christianity. The major discussion about eschatology, the major bone of contention regarding the early church and among church historians, involves the issue of premillennialism. Now, this is one of those great big words and technical terms that has emerged in the course of the great conversation about eschatology in the church. Premillennialism was refined and developed in a couple of major ways in the history of the church. Those refinements and developments come later in the conversation. But in the early church, it's important to define this premillennialism in terms of, its basic essentials. What are the basic essentials of premillennialism? Well, premillennialism is essentially the belief that, Christ will return prior to a thousand-year reign of Christ on earth that will take place before the final and eternal state is ushered in. Let me get this diagram all in one place for you. Here's basic premillennialism then. You have the Old Covenant, the Old Testament period. You have the resurrection, which brings in the gospel age. You have the return of Christ, and the return of Christ does not bring in the final judgment or the eternal state. There is an interregnum, that is to say, an intermediate reign. In the millennium, Christ reigns on earth, and this thousand-year period of time precedes the final judgment and the eternal state. Now, that is premillennialism boiled down to its most basic essentials. Now, it assumes that whole thing assumes a number of other things in terms of how it has to exegete and understand certain passages of Scripture, but that's premillennialism, okay? Now, with regard to premillennialism in the early church, extraordinary claims have been made. Perhaps the most extraordinary is by a very well-known evangelical theologian, Dr. Charles Feinberg, there are several Feinbergs. This is Charles, and he asserted in one of his books that the entire early church of the first three centuries was premillennial almost to a man. Now, that's a slap in the face if you're not a premillennialist. That's a real encouragement if you are, I suppose. Now, if this statement were accurate, it would have great significance for us. You don't have to be Catholic and believe in the authority of early tradition or the tradition of the church to be impressed by the fact that if that statement were true, it would create some presumption in favor of premillennialism, right? It's well known that Roman Catholics place a faith in the traditions of the early church that Protestants refuse to give them. But even Protestants can appreciate this. William Cunningham was a Scottish Presbyterian, and I'm quite confident, very anti-Catholic in the old Scottish Presbyterian way. And yet, this is what he said. Whatever weight may be ascribed to the opinions of the fathers, and whatever grounds that weight, the weight that is ascribed to them may be made to rest, on whatever grounds the weight that is ascribed to them may be made to rest, no one disputes the propriety and the importance of ascertaining, as far as we can, what their views really were. Well, most theologians in modern times, whatever opinions they may entertain upon the general question of the deference to be paid to the fathers, have shown some desire to exhibit in their own behalf the testimony of the early church. I mean, so in other words, you say even Protestants, where they could quote early church fathers in support of their position, have done so. You don't have to be Catholic to want to be able to do that, okay? Whenever it could, with any plausibility, be adduced. And this has given rise to a great deal of learned, voluminous, and often intricate and wearisome discussion. Both of these more ancient and in more modern times, men have acted upon a notion more or less distinctly conceived and more or less earnestly maintained that the fact of a doctrine or system of doctrines having been held by the early church afforded some presumption that it had been taught by the apostles. As a general position, this may perhaps be admitted to be true, but it needs to be very cautiously applied and to be restricted within very narrow limits. Okay? Now, he's right, of course. You know that that although all of us can appreciate the fact that if you could really prove that the early church was premillennial almost to a man, that that would probably mean that the apostles must have taught it. But still, you want to be careful before you swallow that too wholeheartedly, because you know the early church was Episcopalian almost to a man. And do you want to become an Episcopalian? That is to say, the early church was ruled by bishops. Bishops as distinguished from elders. Bishops as ruling over not just one but many churches and with other church officers under them. Now, and Anglicans have made a great deal of hay with the fact that that they can go back and prove that, say, the church in Antioch in Syria had a bishop around the year 107, a bishop as opposed to being ruled by a board of presbyters. So, I mean, there's a lot to be said about that, okay? But I'm just saying we need to be careful about this argument, okay, because it can lead a lot of places you might not really want to go, and which pretty clearly contradict the plain teaching of the New Testament, okay? But nonetheless, still, we've got to admit that it's impressive. And so it's necessary for me to say now that Feinberg's statement to say is an extravagant, and I'm using these words really carefully, is an extravagant overstatement and at best a half-truth. Okay, and I'm going to tell you why I say that now. It's difficult to understand how Feinberg has so plainly distorted the facts of early church history. Part of his problem may be that he has assumed that prophetic views often associated with premillennialism infallibly prove that their authors were premillennialist. In other words, he may have in his mind that premillennialists, well, let's just believe in the Antichrist, that premillennialists believe in the imminent return of Christ. And so any place he finds belief in an Antichrist or belief in the imminent return of Christ, he finds premillennialism. But, you know, a lot of people have believed those things besides premillennialists. And so the argument is fallacious, you know, that kind of argument by association. So the question is not whether the apostolic fathers taught in some sense the doctrine of the imminent return of Christ or the doctrine of the personal Antichrist. Both the Didache, which that's the terminology used for a very early church, Christian book, usually associated with the apostolic fathers. The Didache is teaching. It's the teaching of the 12 apostles. It clearly was not written by the 12 apostles, but that's what it's called. Chapter 16 and the Epistle of Barnabas, again, not really written by Barnabas. And chapters 4 and 15 teach the doctrine of a personal Antichrist. Both these points have historically been associated with premillennialism, and it may be the presence of these views in the early fathers that is partially responsible for the reputation that they have of being premillennial. The doctrines of an imminent return of Christ and the personal Antichrist, however, are adopted by many who are not premillennial. They are held today, for instance, by many that would call themselves amillennial. And that's a term that we'll define in a minute. The essence of premillennialism is not the doctrine of the imminence of Christ's return. It is not the doctrine of a personal Antichrist. It is rather the doctrine of a millennial reign following Christ's return and before the eternal state. That's the essence of the doctrine. And that's what Feinberg has to prove people held. Now, the extravagance of Feinberg's statement will be best seen by an examination of premillennialism in the early church. We're going to look at its early emergence, its subsequent growth, and its final withering. Okay? Early emergence. Only two of the earliest are apostolic fathers, and usually people say there are eight or nine of them, just for your information. Only two of the earliest or apostolic fathers may with any evidence be called, be claimed for premillennialism. And those two are Papias and the person, whoever he was, who wrote the Epistle of Barnabas. The Epistle of Barnabas is usually dated from about the year 130, 135. The quotations from Papias, well, we don't have any books by Papias. The only reason we know Papias as a premillennialist is that a later church history cites him as one, and we'll talk about that. Papias, according to the very first church history that we have from a man by the name of Eusebius of Caesarea, Papias claimed to have heard the Apostle John and to have been a friend of the martyr Polycarp. He is said by that same Eusebius to have written five books in which he recorded statements of John and other early disciples. Now, just in case you're wondering, none of those books survive. But there are excerpts of them recorded in Eusebius' church history. And he lived from about 260 to 340, and I think his church history is dated about 320 or 325. Now, Eusebius intersperses his own comments throughout his excerpts of Papias. And he asserts that Papias was a premillennialist. The actual excerpts of Papias that he gives don't actually say that explicitly. They do say enough things that look like it and sound like early premillennialism that people usually take it for granted that Eusebius was right. Here's Eusebius' comment about Papias, and it's very noteworthy and very important, and we're going to see things like it at a number of places in the history of early premillennialism. Here's what he says. The same person, Papias that is, moreover, has set down other things. Let me see if I can give you just a little bit more of this. Yeah, that's probably, okay, so that'll work. The same person, moreover, set down other things as coming to him from unwritten tradition. Amongst these, some strange parables and instructions of the Savior, and some other things of a more fabulous nature. Now, fabulous here doesn't have a positive connotation, you understand. By fabulous, he means fable-like, okay? Amongst these, he says that there will be a millennium after the resurrection from the dead when the personal reign of Christ will be established on earth. Now, just stop. If you had to judge if Eusebius was a premillennialist from what he just said, what would you say? No. He thinks that this idea of a millennium after Christ comes back is fabulous. In the bad sense of the word, okay? That's how other people read Eusebius as well. He says Papias was a premillennialist, But he doesn't seem to think that that is very impressive. So another things about this statement are interesting. Eusebius' statement makes clear that he was not impressed by Papias' claim that he got his stuff, to use the modern jargon, from the apostles. Indeed, all the reader has to do is read the excerpts from Papias and Eusebius' church history. They're in a footnote, and he will no doubt come to share Eusebius' opinion. Oh, you'd like to know. Well, let's see. Did I put all this stuff in a footnote? Oh. No, you're going to have to go to the Ante-Nicene Fathers, Volume 1, and look at pages 153 and 54 to see that stuff. But take my word for it. When Eusebius describes what he says as fabulous, it's not just his premillennialism, it's the entire way he talks about the millennium that is really far out. Anyway, even for a premillennialist, let me put it that way. Another interesting feature of Eusebius' comment is that it makes clear that he regarded Papias' premillennialism as fabulous. It seems clear from this that Eusebius himself was not a premillennialist. This is our first indication that Feinberg's statement about the early church being premillennial to a man in its first three centuries is really unwarranted. The other apostolic father, by the way, apostolic father, I use this jargon. You know what an apostolic father technically is? Maybe I ought to define that. An apostolic father is actually refers not so much to men as to writings, okay? The apostle, you know the early tradition about when the apostle John died, he was the last living apostle. He died in, anybody know, generally speaking? About the year 95 to 100, okay, let's just be general about it. He was the last living apostle. He died. There's his tombstone, John. He died right there, okay? Now, the writings of the apostolic fathers are writings of men whose lifespans overlapped apostles. Okay? Now, a lot of them you really have to guess about, and some of them are pseudepigraphical. They've been given names that aren't really who wrote them, like the Epistle of Barnabas. Wasn't really written by Barnabas. So some of them are, we know who wrote them, and at least tradition and scholarly study makes clear that some of these men's lifespans overlap those of the apostles. For instance, we shouldn't do things from memory, but Polycarp. Polycarp is the author of one of the writings of the apostolic fathers. Polycarp, my memory serves me, and this is close if it's not absolutely correct, died in 156. I'm going to say 154. Anyway, he died in 154, and we are told in the book written at the time of his death, Martyrdom of Polycarp, that he was around 84. So you subtract 84 from 154, you get the year 70. Okay? Which means that the tradition that he actually heard the Apostle John preach in Asia Minor, where he grew up, is credible, okay? So he's an apostolic father because his lifespan overlaps those of the apostles. Similarly, Clement and the writing First Clement is on all hands regarded generally as the Clement mentioned in the New Testament in Philippians chapter 4. He was an early elder in the church at Rome, wrote his book in the year 97, First Clement's Epistle to the Corinthians. Okay? And he is in all likelihood, therefore his lifespan certainly did overlap those of the apostles. The other one that's pretty authentic is Ignatius, all those Catholic schools and churches and colleges named Ignatius are named after this guy. He was the bishop of Antioch in Syria. And he died, depending on whose story you believe, either in the year 107 or 116. So clearly, again, the seven epistles of Ignatius were writings of a man whose lifespan overlapped those of the apostles. Okay? So that's what an apostolic father is. The Epistle of Barnabas is classed as that because it's dated from about the year 131. So whoever wrote it certainly lived close to the time of the apostles if his lifespan didn't overlap it. Now, one of the problems in reading early Christian literature is, quite frankly, some of it's, you're going to be really disappointed. You go back and read the Apostolic Fathers and think you're going to get something that sounds like the New Testament. You're going to be really disappointed. Okay, I'll just tell you. They're interesting stuff, and there's a lot to be learned, okay? But don't expect the New Testament, and don't expect apostles. There's kind of a cliff phenomena when you come to the Apostolic Fathers, which in one sense is a indirect attestation of the inspiration of the New Testament, because these guys weren't inspired. And even though they intended to follow the apostles, sometimes what they said was, well, take this statement from the epistle to the Barnabas. Andrew, there are no big words in here. It's just going to be hard to follow his train of thought. Can you read that for us? I know it's kind of Andrew Thornquist at this point I'm talking to.
The whole thing?
Yeah, because this is just going to give you an example of what some of these early apostolic fathers' writings is like, and you should get a taste of it, since I haven't quoted Papias to you. Okay. Go ahead.
Further, also, it is written concerning the Sabbath in the Decalogue, which the Lord spoke face to face to Moses on Mount Sinai, and sanctify ye the Sabbath of the Lord with clean hands and a pure heart. And he says that in another place, if my sons keep the Sabbath, then I will cause my mercy to rest upon them. The Sabbath is mentioned at the beginning of the creation thus, and God made in 6 days the works of his hands, and made an end on the seventh day, and rested on it, and sanctified it. Attend, my children, to the meaning of this expression. He finished in 6 days. This implieth that the Lord will finish all things in 6,000 years, for a day is with him 1,000 years.
Just stop right there. How many of you have ever heard anybody say that history is going to be like the creation week, 6,000 years? You heard that? Well, it's really old. I'm not saying it's biblical, but it's really old, and you're hearing it here for the first time in church history in the Epistle of Barnabas. Go ahead.
And he himself testifieth, saying, Behold, today will be as 1,000 years. Therefore, my children, in 6 days, that is, in 6,000 years, all things will be finished. And he rested on the seventh day. This meaneth, when his son coming again shall destroy the time of the wicked man, and judge the ungodly, and change the sun, and the moon, and the stars, then shall he truly rest on the seventh day. Moreover, he says, Thou shalt sanctify it with pure hands and a pure heart. If, therefore, anyone can now sanctify the day which God hath sanctified, except he is pure in heart in all things, we are deceived. Behold, therefore, certainly then, one properly resting sanctifies it, when we ourselves, having received the promise, wickedness no longer existing, and all things having been made new by the Lord, shall be able to work righteousness. Then we shall be able to sanctify it, having been first sanctified ourselves. Further, he says, Your new moons and your Sabbaths I cannot endure. Ye perceive how he speaks. Your present Sabbaths are not acceptable to me, but that is which I have made, namely this, when giving rest to all things, I shall make a beginning of the eighth day, that is, a beginning of another world. Wherefore also we keep the eighth day with joyfulness, the day also on which Jesus rose again from the dead. And when he had manifested himself, he ascended into the heavens.
Okay. Now this is chapter 15 of the Epistle of Barnabas is really important in a lot of different respects that are not eschatological. For instance, it's one of our first references, not the first, but one of the first references to the Christian observance of the first day of the week, or what's called here the eighth day. But I hope you'd agree, after having heard Andrew read it, that's a very complex passage. It's on the basis of this passage that some people claim that the author of the Epistle of Barnabas was a premillennialist. Now, I can see how they get that out of it, but I also don't. But I also have to tell you, I don't think that's this passage is really that clear about a lot of different things. And I think just reading it maybe will help you see this. Superficially read, it has a premillennial ring. There's the seventh day, but then it becomes the eighth day, and what's the difference? It's hard to tell. And he also speaks of the destruction of the wicked man, that is to say, the Antichrist by the second coming of Christ, speaks of the judgment of the ungodly and the rest of the Messiah on that seventh day. But W.J. Greer, in his book entitled, what is it entitled? Sorry, I'm going, it's all the way down here. I had to go to get it. The momentous event, sorry, has this to say. Barnabas' scheme of history was patterned on the week of creation in Genesis 1. The expression, he finished in 6 days, means, he says, that the Lord will finish all things in 6,000 years. The expression, he rested on the seventh day, contains the prophetic meaning that when Christ coming again, shall destroy the time of the wicked man and judge the ungodly and change the sun and the moon and the stars, then shall he truly rest on the seventh day. Premillenarians take this seventh day of the millennium, but what premillenarian is willing to admit that the millennium is ushered in by the judgment of the ungodly, as Barnabas states? According to the Epistle of Barnabas, the seventh day will not come till wickedness is no longer existing and all things have been made new, which is a real problem for a premillennial interpretation of Revelation 20, because it's clear that in Revelation 20, wickedness does still exist in the millennium. Okay? The eighth day is the beginning of another world, but also distinction seems to be done away between the seventh and the eighth day when Barnabas says that the Lord, in giving rest to all things, which happens on the seventh day, makes the beginning of the eighth day, that is, the beginning of another world. It's clear at any rate that Barnabas shuts out the possibility of an earthly millennium in which unregenerate men will be under the reign of Christ. It is perfectly clear, too, that he holds, as all others of his time, that Christians and not Jews are the heirs of the covenant. It is interesting to note that D.H. Crominger, a premillenarian, says the presumption is that Barnabas was what we nowadays call an amillennialist, in the book Millennium in the Church, page 33. Well, Greer's exposition of this difficult passage surely makes an amillennial interpretation of it possible and perhaps necessary. But what is the meaning of this term, amillennialism? And what was the view of Eusebius, the early church father that rejected the premillennialism of Papias? Well, that brings us to discuss this position, which we're going to discover was also widely held in the early church, called amillennialism. The word literally means, if you trace it back to its origins, no millennium. Amillennialists do not, of course, however, deny that the Bible in Revelation 20 teaches a thousand-year reign of Christ. The point of this term is that they do not believe in a future thousand-year reign of Christ after his return. They don't believe in a future golden age. They believe rather that this reign is a figurative reference to the present gospel age. The return of Christ, then, results not in the millennium, but in the final judgment in the eternal state. Now, let me just comment further. Some amillennialists have said we don't like to be called amillennialists because we believe in a millennium. We just don't believe that the millennium takes place after the second coming of Christ. Which is true, and so you can understand why some people have said this isn't a very good name for our position. But are you familiar with the difference between the denotation of a word and the connotation of a word? It's denotation is the precise technical definition of a word. Okay? connotation has to do with the halo meanings that come to be associated with a certain word, okay? Now, this is the problem with the term millennium. Millennium itself simply means a period of 1,000 years. And so in one sense, no Bible believer could be an amillennialist, no millennium, because everybody, including all amillennialists, believe in Revelation 20 and believe that it predicts there a 1,000-year period of time. So there's no way you can be a Bible believer. And in terms of the denotation of the term millennium, not believe in the millennium. This is there in Revelation 20, and everybody can see it. The problem is, however, and this is, I think, where the term amillennialism came from, the problem is millennium, in the way that it's used, and in terms of the things it's associated with, doesn't merely mean 1,000 years or 1,000-year period of time, does it? When you hear the term millennium, what does it connote? What ideas is it associated with? That's a real question, not rhetorical. Besides a 1,000-year period of time, doesn't it connote, and isn't it associated with other ideas when you hear it? Like a long time. But what kind of time is a millennium? What?
It's in place.
There's a rule in place. Okay, it's associated with Christ's rule. What else?
New age.
A new age? New in what respects?
Different reign, like he was talking about.
Yeah. But the character of it. Would you agree with me if I said that the term millennium is usually associated with the idea of a golden age? A period of time in which righteousness and peace and prosperity characterize the world. Well, I think that those are the connotations of the word millennium. Now, in terms of, therefore, a great 1,000-year period of time or even a long period of time of righteousness, peace, and prosperity before the end of the world or even after Christ comes back before the eternal state, well, in the sense of that, that's where the idea of amillennial comes from, because amillennialists don't believe in that. They don't believe in that kind of golden age. And so depending whether you take the denotation of the word, simply a 1,000-year period of time, or the connotation, golden age of righteousness, peace, and prosperity, depending on how you define the term millennium is going to make a difference on whether you want or I want or anyone wants perhaps to be called an amillennialist. Anyway, look at the chart. You understand what I'm saying there? So I don't mind the word amillennialism, but I take it as a rejection of the idea of a golden age of righteousness, peace, and prosperity before the eternal state, okay? But this is amillennialism. Old covenant, resurrection of Christ. But now the gospel age is equivalent to the millennium. The 1,000-year period of time is taken as referring to the period of time between Christ's first and second advents, between his resurrection and his return. And at Christ's return, you have, well, the resurrection and the judgment of the ungodly, and this ushers in the eternal state. Well, the righteous go away into eternal life, the wicked into eternal punishment, and that's it. Okay? That's amillennialism, very simply stated, right? Questions? Well, to make a long story short, if this plausible, I think it's plausible anyway, amillennial interpretation of Barnabas, or whoever Barnabas was, is adopted or even entertained as possible, then the only clear evidence for premillennialism in the earliest fathers, the apostolic fathers, is the highly questionable witness of Papias. All the other fathers are really silent on the subject of premillennialism. There are 9 or 10 different classes of writings that are classed as apostolic fathers. only two of them are even arguably saying anything about premillennialism. And one, and Barnabas is really highly questionable whether that's really his position or not. Papias, we will grant that he was. But no, that's not the true in the next, that's not true in the next period of time. And so we got to come here to the subsequent growth of premillennialism in the early church, because it did blossom. The above treatment of the early emergence of premillennialism has restricted itself to the earliest fathers of the church who lived before the year 150. The evidence for premillennialism among them is, as we have seen, scanty indeed. In the next period of early church history, however, there was an undeniable growth of premillennial teaching. Premillennialism enjoyed great popularity during the second through the fourth centuries of the Christian era. This becomes evident, first of all, in the writings of Justin Martyr. Justin, called martyr because he was martyred for Christ. Justin Martyr, since his writings date from approximately 160, may be mentioned first here. He makes mention of his premillennialism in his dialogue with Trypho the Jew, chapter 76 to 81. It's very clear that Justin is a premillennialist. He says in chapter 80, and Andrew Harrison's going to read that for us.
But I and others who are right-minded Christians on all points are assured that there will be a resurrection of the dead in 1,000 years in Jerusalem, which will then be built, adorned, and enlarged, as the prophet Ezekiel and Isaiah and others declare.
Right. That statement's a very clear testimony to Justin's premillennialism. The problem is that it's also clear about something else. Justin's also very clear that not all Christians agree with him. You see it? I and others who are right-minded Christians on all points are assured that there will be a resurrection of the dead. Now, that's implied there. But it's made explicit in a later chapter. Trypho the Jew, here's the context, is cross-examining Justin about his belief that Jerusalem will be rebuilt as the center of a joyful fellowship of the Christ and his people during the millennium. Is he really serious, asked Trypho, in affirming a doctrine held also by the Jews? Justin replies, I am not so miserable a fellow, Trypho, as to say one thing and to think another. I admitted to you formerly that I and many others are of this opinion and believe that such will take place, as you assuredly are aware. But on the other hand, I signify to you that many who belong to the pure and pious faith and are true Christians think otherwise. So you see, the very statement that gives evidence of early premillennialism also gives evidence of a division among right-minded Christians, Orthodox Christians, that at least, on this issue. So in this amazing statement, we learn that even in the early church, premillennialism was the subject of argument. There were true Christians, says Justin, in the second century who were not premillennialist. Now, I think Justin's attitude is commendable and should have been imitated by many since this day. Premillennialism is not a test of orthodoxy. I was raised in churches where it was. Nor is it a mark of heresy. Too many premillennialists have said or strongly implied that anyone who was not a premillennialist was a heretic. Well, but the problem is there are heretics who are premillennialists, like Jehovah's Witnesses and Mormons as well. So this whole making of premillennialism a test of orthodoxy is wrong. Too many opponents of premillennialism have repaid the compliment, and this is also wrong. Well, I'm going to stop right there. It's not a very good stopping point. Let's see, how far do I have to go to? I'm going to go just a couple more minutes. We'll jack back the time of dinner by 5 minutes, okay? It's just so I can get to a good stopping point. Certain other considerations should be kept in mind by modern premillennialists when they consider Justin's premillennialism. The first thing they should keep in mind is this is a very different kind of premillennialism than is taught today. One of the great thrusts of Justin's dialogue with Trypho the Jew is that the doctrine that the Christians are the true Jews. Now, you have to go read the book if you want to. But this is a pervasive emphasis of Justin in his dialogue with Trypho the Jew. Everywhere he argues that it's not the physical Jews, it's the Christians that are the true Jews. And this is not said in one or two statements. It permeates the entire book. So W.J. Greer is right when he says Justin's millennium will have no special place at all for the Jew, for he tells us over and over that Christians are the true Israelite race. Modern premillennialists should also be aware of the fact that Justin's premillennialism is inconsistent. Greer ably brings out these inconsistencies in Justin's premillennialism. Jeannie, can you read that for me, please?
When Justin Martyr is speaking of the kingdom for which Christians look, he denies that it is a human kingdom. You suppose we speak of a human kingdom, whereas we speak of that which is with God. Justin speaks of a general judgment at Christ's second coming, when death shall forever quit those who believe on him and be no more, when some are sent to be punished unceasingly into judgment and condemnation of fire. But those shall exist in freedom from suffering, from corruption, and from grief and immorality. From these statements, one would suppose there was no room for an earthly millennium in his teaching. Yet inconsistently, he says elsewhere that there will be a resurrection of the dead in 1,000 years in Jerusalem, which will be built, adorned, and enlarged, and that, therefore, the general and, in short, the eternal resurrection and judgment of all men would likewise take place.
Now, what Greer is pointing out here is something that Hill says in Regnum Caelorum. There really is evidence. It's not clear in some cases, but it's there, that a lot of these guys actually had changed their position. At one point held one of these two eschatological positions and then switched to the other one. It's clear later on that Augustine was a premillennialist, then rejected it and became an amillennialist. If there is evidence that guys like Justin, as we're going to see next hour, Irenaeus, were amillennialists and then became premillennialists. At any rate, that's the argument that Greer is making here, that there's some inconsistencies in Justin's writings, and it may, be an indication that at some place along the line, Justin had changed his position. At any rate, he makes clear that there was a division of opinion among genuine Christians on this issue, even in the middle of the second century. We should be surprised if there's a difference of opinion today. All right, we're going to stop right here. Those of us who are eating here, I think they have dinner ready down there for us, so we'll just dismiss ourselves. Like I said, if you're not getting dinner here, then Ritzy's is up on the corner and other places down the street, and you're welcome to bring it back and eat it in here. Just be careful. Okay? So you're dismissed.